Hello, and welcome to this week's edition of the Perpetual Notion Machine half-hour science program for Thursday, March 2nd, 2017. Each week, we discuss scientific research, news, or science happenings and events in the Madison, Wisconsin area. I'm your host, Lincoln Tice. Our topic today is the evolution of stormwater management in Madison. This will continue a series of several shows looking at our local water resource here that I began last year. We did a show on Madison's municipal water supply, one on the groundwater resource, and a show on our surface waters. It was during this last segment, where we talked about our rivers and lakes, that the importance of controlling runoff became apparent to protecting our water. So that is what we will focus on today. We will learn the geography and history of why Madison has problems with stormwater, and what the city is doing to make things better. It's a good time to talk about urban runoff, because with springtime ahead, we are bound to get a lot of rainfall in the next 2 months. Stormwater management is complicated, but thankfully I have two local experts with me in the studio to walk us through it. First, I have Ken Potter, Emeritus Professor from the University of Wisconsin in Civil and Environmental Engineering Department. Also joining us is Greg Fries with the City of Madison Engineering Office. I thank you both for coming in and sharing your expertise with our listeners.
Thanks, Lincoln.
Yeah, pleased to be here, Lincoln.
So, Madison is in the middle of the Four Lakes Basin, and much of the isthmus and surrounding areas were developed on wetlands, making us prone to flooding. Would you guys say that we have a more challenging situation than most cities to manage our stormwater?
Well, I'd say it's probably more interesting than most places because we have such a variety of conditions. We're both flat in a lot of places. We have some steep places. We have large lakes, which complicate things. So I think it's many cities have similar problems, but ours is pretty unique.
Yeah, I would tend to agree. You know, the challenge from my perspective, oftentimes is the isthmus, the thing that you let in with, because that is the area that was most filled. But developing areas have different challenges and opportunities.
Yeah, so what streams or channels are most significant in understanding the geography of how stormwater moves through Madison?
I think from a flooding perspective, at least the one that I'm most familiar with here is the Yahara River and how much that flows through the city of Madison and really actually drains only a relatively very small part of it. And all the man-made interactions that have occurred with that river over time. You know, from, as you mentioned, it was a big, the isthmus was really a large wetland to created straight channel to a system with locks that we have now that artificially raise Lake Mendota, you know, roughly 4 feet above Lake Monona.
Yeah, and I think the key point you make there is the fact that the Madison area is only a small part of the watershed of the Yahara. A lot of it is north of here, and it's agricultural lands. And that's something that's going to develop in the future and something we're going to have to be careful with because flows could get much larger on the Yahara River.
Ken, can you tell us a little bit about the history of development in the Madison area that has changed the land and brought us to where we are today?
Well, here's where Madison's similar to most places in the world, in fact, in that the pattern of development is pretty consistent. We had agriculture here beginning in the early 1800s, and that itself had significant effects because lots of wetlands were drained in order to produce crops, lowering the water table and changing the flow in a lot of streams. A lot of streams were straightened, and we see that a lot here in Madison, but we also see it in other parts of Wisconsin. Then development began late in the 19th century, early 20th century, and the only stormwater management back then really was to just find a way to get the water into the lake or into the streams, and nothing close to what we do today. That went on for a long time, and of course a lot of impervious area was created, which increased the amount of runoff. It wasn't until well after World War II that in this country we started managing peak flows from urbanizing areas, And then in the late 80s, we started dealing with water quality. And then after that, we started dealing with just the total quantity. So there's been a progression here, just like there has been in most of the United States and, in fact, in much of the world.
So how going back to the beginning of agriculture, how were the wetlands drained?
I guess in a variety of ways. I think they mainly ditched. So they did ditches to lower the water table. Can't really think of too many other ways.
Yeah, the common thing that was done back then is the precursor to, I guess urban cities doing stormwater system was drainage districts. They were created largely by groups of farmers, and the job primarily was to create a very rectilinear drainage system that could make a whole bunch of land arable. And then farmers would also install drain tiles underneath their fields to further drain the land and make it more productive for crops.
So what streams were impacted by this? My personal watershed is Starkweather Creek. Would that be one of the streams that was affected?
That was probably, for Madison area, that's probably the most significantly impacted, although in the northern part of the watershed, there's probably more. But in the Madison area, Starkweather actually still had a drainage district in place and functioning when I started working for the city in the early 90s.
As far as an agricultural drainage district?
Correct, yep.
Wow. Yeah, and then you mentioned some of the streams to the north. We have, Pheasant Branch Creek coming in Middleton. And then we have Six Mile Creek coming from near Wanakee. Would those have also been straightened?
Well, no, but it's an interesting story with Pheasant Branch. And that is the Moore Airport, what was Moore Airport, now Middleton Airport, was actually the lake bottom of Lake Mendota when Lake Mendota was much higher as a result of the ice. After the ice left, we had a great elevation difference. That land there probably didn't produce much runoff, but as people started to farm it, it did, and that water had to work its way down about 60 feet to get down to Lake Mendota. So I don't know if you've hiked in the trail there, but
yeah,
there's a nice
gorge.
Steep gorge in there, right, and it's a very narrow gorge, and it's a narrow gorge because it's a young gorge, because most of the erosion occurred once urbanization really set in and impervious surfaces were developed. So that's been a huge problem over the last 30 years in terms of channel cutting down because of that excess water and then undercutting the slopes and having slope collapse because that whole land area is composed of sand. And so there have been times when hundreds of feet of the valley side have just collapsed into the stream and endangered houses and so on and so forth. So it's a really interesting example of the kinds of things that can happen.
Yeah, I've seen some of the old photos there in Pheasant Branch Conservancy because I enjoy those trails, and it's pretty epic erosion that took place. Another creek that seems to have changed a lot is Winger Creek. Could either of you talk about for Winger Creek? I understand that there really wasn't a creek there. It sort of flowed into Monona Bay through a marshland from Lake Winger, and that was all channelized.
Yeah, Winger is a complicated history. We call it Lake Winger, but you're correct in that if you go back, I don't have the years right off the top of my head, but it was essentially a large marsh at one point. And the dam that has created the lake for us and the river was all essentially man-made and dredged over in a number of times over the decades. And so the river that we see today really bears almost no resemblance to what was there today, nor does the lake, for that matter. The lake is extremely shallow now, but without that dam, it wouldn't be a lake at all. It would just be a very large wetland.
Yeah, and my impression, what I was trying to say, is that it used to flow over, I guess, I've heard it called the Little Isthmus, like Park Street, like directly into Monona Bay.
Oh.
But it was channeled to the south.
That could be. I don't know exactly where, but it was the channel that we see today was completely man-made. I mean, they relocated that stream.
Yeah, and again, as we talked about, the Ohio River channel is pretty much man-made. I've also read that the reason that the isthmus was filled in was to be developed for industry. And the river was shifted to the east, where the channel is now. In a uniquely Madison twist, this was done as a compromise because government and university elites didn't want any factories in Madison. So they gave them land that they thought was unusable and shifted the Ohio River to the east. So going back to Starkweather Creek, which is our largest urban stream, what are the problems associated with Starkweather Creek?
Well, it's got several problems. One thing it's important to recognize is it's one of those streams that was affected by glaciation, and so in fact much of that watershed was a wetland following the drainage of Lake Mendota, and that persisted for 10,000 years since the ice left, and then the drainage came in. And I think the key thing is that prior to human impact, the flow out of that system was probably almost entirely groundwater discharge, so a very constant flow of relatively cold water in the summer and warm water in the winter, so it's flowing year-round at a fairly constant flow. And that probably changed most drastically when a lot of filling and urbanization began in the 20th century. And so now there's been a lot of development. There's a lot of impervious surface air that's creating surface runoff, which is a lot flashier. It occurs a lot of water in a short time and much less base flow. There's probably a third or a fourth of what the base flow was originally. It's hard to say for sure. And so that's a major problem. You want to talk about the water quality issues, maybe?
Yeah, I mean, as Ken mentioned, right? So we've straightened this channel, we've put it where we wanted to put it, and then we've added a whole bunch more water to it. And up until really, I would say, the early 90s, from a water quality perspective, all the development that's happened has been essentially untreated. And the result of that is there's a lot of sediment that has been deposited in the creek. There are pollutants associated with that largely at this point in time are largely associated with you know, our main mode of transportation, cars. And so we have to try and kind of make up for lost ground here. We have to try and find a way to do some treatment on there in a watershed that has largely been developed without treatment. And that's very common in all, you know, urban cities that have been developed in the 20th century without what I would call modern stormwater treatment systems, which have only really been around, you know, 25, 30 years for the most part, at least in any large amount.
So for our listeners, the main development that we're talking about here is things like Easttown Mall. How about the Dane County Airport?
Yeah, the Starkweather has two branches. One goes out to Easttown Mall, and one goes up past and through the airport. And both of those areas, all the way up to the airport and all the way out to Easttown Mall, were developed without any stormwater treatment at all. Just conveyance, right? Get it to the creek as quickly as possible and make it go away, which was, you know, the treatment standard well into the 70s and early 80s. So now we're looking at ways where we can go back into these watersheds and do some practices to try and reduce some of the pollutants. Madison has to, we're required to, and we also want to. Even before we were required, we were doing this. We're trying to remove suspended solids and total phosphorus from the water. The phosphorus is the most notable thing. That's what gives you the algae blooms on the lakes in the summer. And it's extraordinarily difficult to remove a pound of phosphorus from urban stormwater. Very costly. You know, to the tune of, you know, it can range probably in the low of a couple $100 a pound to a high of $1,000 a pound. And we're in conjunction, City of Madison in conjunction with Dane County is looking to do a treatment facility on the east branch of Starkweather that would get about 1,600 pounds of phosphorus. So even though that's a drop in the bucket of the lake budget of phosphorus as a whole, it's a very significant number when you look at it from an urban stormwater perspective.
Wow, cool. And is that in the area of the concrete plant, kind of in that area north of Milwaukee Street that hasn't yet been developed?
That is correct. That area is currently in the town of Blooming Grove, and that is where we are looking at doing that project, actually in the old quarry pond that is actually on the site.
Nice. And is there a plan for that area to be developed, like, in the near future? Is that part of why this might happen?
That's a whole different discussion. That area is actually part of a boundary agreement between Madison and Blooming Grove, so it won't be coming into the city for some time yet. I think it's about 10 years. But we would do the project, actually, a City of Madison project, in actually the town of Blooming Grove. We would purchase the land, and it would be done in the town of Blooming Grove.
Cool. So we hear the term green infrastructure. What are some other types of green infrastructure that the city has worked on?
So there's lots of different green infrastructures and ways to think about that, but the most common are like green roofs. There's a couple different varieties of those. Pervious pavement. What else?
Rain gardens.
Yeah,
bioretention.
Yeah, rain gardens, bioretention. Madison, the city part, has been largely rain gardens and bioretention, although there are projects in this that are being developed in the city that have green roofs and some pervious pavement, although those have not been quite as adopted quite so quickly.
Yeah, there's one thing we have to be a little careful about, though, when we do infiltration in an area that was developed a long time ago where there weren't as clear rules about what you could dump and where you could dump it. And so there is a chance that we could move some contaminants that are buried into the lake. I'm not sure there's a high probability there, but I think that's something when we do green infrastructure, I think we're always going to be careful to make sure that the places we infiltrate water, that we don't have anything buried there. And I know there's some landfills, at least one landfill there, for example, that there is some seepage out of that landfill, and it's something we got to watch.
From a green infrastructure standpoint, really the actual, at least from my perspective, the real freebie here is a green roof, especially on a ultra dense urban development. If you do an intensive green roof, you can oftentimes use that green roof as actually open space for the people who are living in the apartment or the condo, and it usually has some pretty significant heat and heating and cooling benefits for the structure itself and for the surrounding area, and it reduces runoff. So it's a win all the way around, and you don't have to worry about the same problems Ken was talking about what's underneath the ground, because it all stays on the roof.
Yeah, I agree. In the dense urban areas, green roofs really a good solution.
Yeah, I've seen some really nice green roofs lately, like on the University Square development, on the new Southeast campus dining hall, and the library, too, I think.
Yeah, several Madison buildings, City of Madison buildings, have a version of green roofs that have been installed in the last, like, 5-6 years.
What about this permeable pavement thing? I'm a little skeptical about the idea of permeable pavement. It doesn't quite seem possible. Is that really feasible?
Well, yeah, there have been some pretty successful permeable pavements. There's really three kinds. One is asphalt, permeable asphalt. So it's basically asphalt where you don't put the fines in. And it doesn't cost any more as long as you...
The fine gravel, particles, sand.
Well, even finer than that. So there's sand and so on that goes into asphalt. So you keep that out. And it doesn't cost any more, but the problem is you have to use a full batch in order they won't sell you less than a full batch. And I think it's really successful on things like trails and parking lots to some extent. You could do a similar thing with permeable concrete, and there's some parking lots in that. I think one of the questions everybody worries about is how well they're going to last over time and how much you have to clean them, vacuum them. You can use high-energy vacuums to clean out the any particles that might get might clog up the pores. But typically what they've found is that only the upper few centimeters, or not even a few, part of a centimeter, will pick up some of that material. And so I think there's been some success with that. The U.S. Geological Survey, we have a great office here in the Madison area, has done a fair amount of research in that. And that looks like it can be pretty successful.
Yep.
What about maybe going back to some old road technologies like stone or cobblestone or even gravel? That's like the original permeable pavement, right?
they do have one of the kind of the last permeable pavement Ken didn't mention was they have pavers that are much like the original bricks, right, that you used, but you would leave corners open, and those corners are filled with what I would call pea gravel. And people do use those for their driveways. You know, from a residential standpoint, there's a lot of ways to do this that actually makes sense. It's a little harder on roads because you have to carry the load associated with trucks. And trucks are extremely heavy. If all you have to carry is car load, almost any of these pavements can really be effective. You can also do, you know, if you roll back the clock, you know, 40, 50 years, right after World War II, most driveways were not all concrete. They were two strips of concrete about 2.5 feet wide all the way back to your detached garage. And I've seen people doing that again as well in new construction as a way to reduce their impact as part of the new part of the construction process.
Yeah, and that reminds me that my bill, you know, the city charges for impermeable, your sewer bill for impermeable surface. So I would love to rip up my driveway and, you know, add pavers or whatnot.
One thing you got to think about is snow removal, though. So.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I'd want to be shoveling on
grass.
On grass or even on pavers might be a challenge, but lots of issues.
Okay, so I think we covered streams pretty well. Thanks, you guys, for understanding. One important aspect of our urban stormwater management that I don't understand very well is our storm sewers. This might be because they are underground, and I can't paddle canoe in them like I can in the Ahara River or Starkweather Creek. So, Greg, how do our storm sewers work?
So we have in Madison a separate storm sewer system. So what I would call the more modern system, where we have sanitary sewer, which comes from your house, and that goes in its own set of pipes to the sewer treatment plant, and storm sewer, which takes rainwater largely in runoff, and that goes to the lakes and rivers surrounding other communities. In Wisconsin, it's really only Milwaukee, have a combined sewer system. But here, basically, all of our storm sewers function by gravity, and they break largely with the land. So if you looked at a topographic map of the city of Madison and you kind of identified ridges, you would see, you could draw a map very close to the one I have hanging in my office that shows me where our sewer divides are. And in the older part of the city, you know, I would largely categorize that as from, say, Midvale Boulevard on the west and maybe from Stoughton Road on the east. Those portions of the city have very little in the way of stormwater treatment. They are a lot of inlets, a lot of pipes, and the only method of treatment we have are street sweeping largely and catch basins, which really the best way to think about that is a big pit underground where sediment can collect, and we take they're called vectors. They are literally big trucks, vacuums on trucks. They're huge, and they come through and suck out the material 2 times a year. So the system itself is all gravity, which makes the isthmus that really wild card, because when the lake levels come up and Lake Monona cannot really be controlled, because it's not controlled by a dam. It kind of responds to the other lakes. When that comes up, the isthmus drains extremely slowly.
So do most of the storm sewers just feed into the nearest stream or lake?
Correct. Yep. So virtually every stream you named off in your introduction takes a stormwater either from the city of Madison or the city of Middleton or the city of Sun Prairie. Wanakee as well is in, you know, you've mentioned Door Creek is Sun Prairie, 6 Mile is largely Wanakee, Pheasant Branch is largely Middleton, although Madison has a component in that.
So we must just have miles and miles of concrete pipes under the ground.
Yes, you do. Yeah, I don't know the number, but I can tell you this. In terms of catch basins, we have 19,000 catch basins in the city of Madison because we have to clean them. And that number I know. Excuse me, 1,900, my bad, 1,900.
How often do those pipes have to be replaced?
Typically, storm sewers last about 100 years or more. We do have storm sewers that are over 100 years in the downtown area.
Cool. So there are a lot of pollutants that we release into the environment. We've talked about a lot of them, road salt, phosphorus, other nutrients from fertilizers. There's also herbicides from people's lawns and volatile organic compounds released by tires on our roads. Would it ever be possible for the city to divert and treat any of this water before it is recycled back into our water supply?
And, you know, Ken mentioned earlier that that's what's been done, really, I would say, since the early 90s. We try and treat that water before releasing it. And so all new development has that requirement on it. In fact, the stormwater requirements now versus when I started with the city 26 years ago are, I mean, it's just amazing the significance of the difference. But doing it in a retrofit basis is very, very difficult in that most stormwater treatment practices require land to make them work. They're large in terms of percentage of area required to treat it. It takes up a lot of room.
And is the treating done through the natural environment, or is it done like chemically? Or
usually the primary process is settling. Okay, so if you think of the stormwater retention ponds, they largely settle particles, but Ken mentioned bioretention or in the green infrastructure. Those filter particles, and those are the easiest things to retrofit in, actually, because you can do them in a relatively small space, but they only treat a small area at the same time.
Got it. So it seems that Madison has seen increased flooding lately. Most recently last July, when numerous low-lying areas and roadways flooded, causing damage to cars and property. So, Greg, what happened? Did the city's storm sewers just get overwhelmed with the large amount of rainfall in that short time?
Madison storm sewers, and I think most urban storm sewers, are extremely susceptible to high-intensity, short-duration events. And that storm on July 21st of last year, it was exactly that, especially on the west side where there were a few local cells that dumped, you know, over 3.5 inches of rain in about 2 hours. Our systems don't respond well to that particular type of event, and it's inevitable you get localized flooding, but what we like to do is route it someplace safe that doesn't do damage to property.
I received a mailer from the sewer department asking people to avoid littering because the garbage was getting stuck on the guards over the culverts and blocking water flow. Is this a big problem in the flooding?
I would say probably in some areas it can be, but the bigger problem actually is if that happens in the fall with leaves, actually, because if you leave your leaves in the street, not only does it create pollution in terms of total phosphorus, but then it creates flooding because the leaves are washed down to our inlets, clog the inlets, and then we flood as well. So it's kind of a double-sided bad.
Yeah, that's the one thing citizens could do.
Yes, I agree.
Improve both water quality and flooding is to keep the leaves out of the street and to make sure they don't get in the street. And, you know, it's a great thing to compost, by the way. So compost your leaves.
Yeah, also this winter there has been even some flood warnings already with this insane record-breaking early thaw that we had last week. Did you get ice damming of the storm sewers?
That always happens to some extent because our plows never usually fully reach the curb, so the inlets can be underneath ice. We didn't have a whole lot of problem with that this year. We keep a list of where the known problems are, and we go and clear them with heavy equipment when we're having expected rains on a frozen ground like we did this year.
All right, well, that's all the time we have for tonight on the Perpetual Motion Machine. Thanks so much to my distinguished guests, Dr. Ken Potter from UW Civil and Environmental Engineering and Greg Fries of the City of Madison Engineering Department. Thanks also to our engineer, Peter Berg, for engineering the show. There seems to be a lot of engineering going on in the studio tonight. I'm the only one here who's not an engineer, your host and producer, Lincoln Tice. We're currently looking for volunteers to get involved in making Perpetual Motion Machine a reality each week. If interested, please shoot us an email at scienceonwart@gmail.com. You can also visit the station website at www.wrtfm.org. There you'll find our archive of show summaries and podcasts. Tune in next Thursday at 7 for another all-new episode of the Perpetual Motion Machine. Thanks for listening to our volunteer-produced local science.